When you struggle with doubt, one of the first things I would encourage you to do is look up. Look at the mountains, look at the heavens, look at the trees, look at the sky, look at the stars, look up. Because the God that we worship is the God of creation.
You know, it's easy to look at Old Testament illustrations of idols and claim we no longer worship idols. Yet here in our 21st century modern culture, we do still have and worship idols. And at the end of the day, there are some practical applications that our text will present to us as we take a look at the heavy hand of God. We're in 1 Samuel chapter 5, verses 1 through 12. We invite you to join us there for today's edition of Growing in Grace, as our teacher and pastor Steve Ballantyne reminds us that we serve a living God. Here's Pastor Steve in today's program.
If you're one that reads ahead the text that we're going to look at in a given week, I would guess this is one of those texts you look at and think, huh, what are you going to do with this? We know this story. This is the recounting of 7 months of the Ark of God in the possession of the Philistines. And there's no mention of Israel. There's no mention of the Israelites. Other than that, it's the God of Israel and the ark that belongs to the God of Israel. But we are entirely in this narrative in the Philistine territory. And I'm just reminded of what Paul tells us in Romans 15, verse 4, that these things are written for our instruction. That when we read a text such as this that seems so separate from our experience and so distant from the day-to-day that we walk through in life now, these temples and idols falling over, and even the Ark of the Covenant seems so foreign to us, that there are lessons here for us, that this is God's intent, was not just to speak to that original audience, but to his people through the centuries. And that the word of God is given, and as Paul says to Timothy, it is profitable for doctrine, reproof, correction, and instruction in righteousness. And that is true of 1 Samuel 5. It is written for us, and there is benefit here. You know the context. We've looked at it the last couple of weeks. Israel and Philistia have gone into battle, and Israel was defeated. And then they have the idea that they need to bring the ark with them, and they go and get the ark from Shiloh. They take it into battle, and they suffer even a greater defeat, and it's the end of the family of Eli and the low point in this whole narrative, indeed one of the lowest points in the history of Israel. The ark of God is captured, and now it's in the possession of their arch enemy. Now, coming into chapter 5, what's the mindset of these people, can we imagine? Well, the Philistines certainly think they have just dominated, because they have, the people of Israel. And in the thinking of the ancient world, they thought that they not only dominated Israel, but they dominated Israel's God. You remember in chapter 4, when the ark is brought into the camp of Israel and there's cheering for it, it's the Philistines that are afraid. It's the Philistines that remember what this God did in Egypt. It's the Philistines that remember what this God did in the desert. And so they are terrified, and they bolster the energy, and there's a great speech. We got to go for it, guys. We got to fight them. And now they've defeated them utterly and completely and in a humiliating manner, and they've captured the Ark of God for themselves. They've defeated Israel. They've defeated the God. And I would suggest to you the hint in chapter 4, and this is what the practice was in the ancient world. When you defeated a people, they became your slaves. So the discussion had to be, on a military level, when are we going to go in and clean up? When are we going to finish these people off and make them subject to us? We have the God of the sea. Now we have the God of the inland, the God of what these people call the promised land. He's ours now. He's on our side now. Let's clean up. How about Israel? They had just lost a battle after taking the Ark of God in with them. Maybe there's some asking, is the God of the Philistines more powerful than our God? Certainly the Philistines believed that. They went into the battle fully aware of the reputation of the God of Israel, and they had won, and now this box that contained their God is in their possession. So what's next? Revenge? Counterattack? How can Israel even contemplate that? That's where we are when chapter 5 opens. Israel is under judgment here, and we get a glimpse of scenes that do not unfold in the eyes of Israelites. This is unfolding outside of their presence, outside of the camp. So imagine this. You have Shiloh, the place of the temple of God, the ark, where the ark was placed. The family of Eli has been displaced. The people have been defeated. They're under judgment, and they're asking the question of the end of chapter 4, where is the glory of God? Is the glory gone? The glory is absent, but they're under God's judgment. What they don't know at this time is that in the very camp of the Philistines, the God that they are wondering if he's abandoned them, that very God is preserving them. In this moment, in the midst of their rebellion, in the midst of their disregard for him and his glory, in the midst of their doubt that maybe he wasn't faithful to his covenant and he has abandoned us and his glory is gone, in those moments, God is still preserving them. God is still fighting on their behalf. At a point where the Philistine army on paper could have come in and wiped them out, God is preventing that, and they don't even know it. The most likely next step is Israel's total destruction, and Israel is powerless to stop it, but God isn't. We see him being faithful even when his people aren't. I think the primary purpose of chapter 5 is to demonstrate the superior power of God, the universal superior power of God. There are connections here to the God of the Exodus. The Philistines are the ones that notice that. And you're going to see the plagues, and you're going to see a crying out to God that parallels what we see in the Exodus. But what we see here is the greatness of God on display. We'll look at it in a way I hope that's helpful for you by looking at three attributes of God that manifest themselves in this story. The first is this. We see the jealous God who topples every rival. The jealous God that topples every rival. And I know sometimes when we hear the language of God being jealous, we can be bothered by that. But listen, these are the exact words of God. Exodus 34, "You shall worship no other God, for the Lord whose name is jealous is a jealous God." Jealous not in the sinful sense that we're jealous. He's not envious. But he's longing and desiring of all worship and all affection, that it go in the proper place, because he is worthy of it and is best for us when we do that. And we see here a God that will not allow his glory to be shared. So verse 1, the Philistines capture the ark of God. Now, if you look back at verse 22, where does it end? The ark of God has been captured. And then he repeats it. The Philistines captured the ark of God. Why mention this again? Well, because there's no underlining and there's no bold text in Hebrew. So one of the ways that ancient writers would emphasize something is through repetition. He doesn't want us to miss the point. The ark of God is in the hands of the enemies. This is a devastating reality. And so we open the account with the stark reminder that this holy artifact that represents the very presence of God among his people is gone. The name of this child, Ichabod, is representative of the glory having departed. And the text, the way it flows, gives the clear impression that the Philistines think they're in control. Not just of the box, but of the God of the box. He now belongs to them. They have subdued Israel, and they have subdued Israel's God. They can move him wherever they want and do with him whatever they want, so they think. You remember Israel in chapter 4 treats God, uses box, and they treat God as a token. He's useful, but not worthy. They saw God as a utility to be managed, a tool in their tool belt, but not the God that was to be bowed down to be repented to. And so instead of repenting and turning back from their sin, they embraced the view of the pagan cultures around them and treated God like a good luck charm in battle. And this is the judgment of God upon them for doing that. And so the Philistines capture the ark. They take it down to the city of Ashdod and they place it in the temple of Dagon. These ones that were afraid of the ark are now thinking they're in control of the ark, that the glory and the power that was in the ark, whatever it was, is less than the glory and the power of their god, Dagon. That's the sense. We thought so highly of this god, but it turns out our god is greater. Our god is stronger. Our god is more glorious. Now understand, in the ancient world, Israel has a unique perspective on religion. They are monotheists. They believe in one God. It is the primary tenet, the first tenet of Judaism. The Lord our God is one. This is repeated in the Ten Commandments. It's repeated in the Shema, the prayer that they would pray every day, Deuteronomy 6, Isaiah 45, verses 5 and 6, over and over and over again. This is declared, God is one. There's only one God. He has no rivals. That's not the view of the Philistines. That's not the view of the surrounding nations. They're polytheistic. They believe in all sorts of gods. And so these religions believe that often that a particular god had sovereignty in the area where they lived. You had the god of the sea, the god of the harvest. You had god of fertility. You had the god of the storms. You had the god of the sun. And so these gods were very regional and had very limited power. They were sovereign up to a point in an area or over an area. You think of Baal, which we're so familiar with in the Old Testament, who was the god of the rain or the storms. Asherah, who was the god of fertility. Those are some examples. So when the nations went to war, the perspective was, we're not only going to battle, but our gods are battling. That's the perspective. The Philistines, under the rule of Dagon, are going into battle against the Israelites under the rule of Yahweh. And when they battle, whoever was victorious, it wasn't just the people, but the gods that were fighting. And in this case, they see Dagon as having defeated Yahweh. But they don't struggle with Yahweh being real. He's just another god. And so they do what is very typical in that day. They would take this artifact or an idol of the god that was defeated, and they would place it in the temple of their great god. Dagon is the great god of the Philistines. He's the top dog. And so they take the ark to the city of Ashdod, which is one of five major cities in Philistia, and to the temple of Dagon. They don't destroy it. They recognize there's power here. They recognize that this is a good thing to have on our side. We've seen what this ark can do and the God that Israel worship. We've seen its power. But they obviously see him as subservient and in subjection to Dagon. And so that's what they do. Symbolically, he's been defeated and they place him in Dagon's temple. And now he sits at the feet of Dagon. To them, this box is just another idol. It's no different than the idols that they had made themselves. Now, who is Dagon? Dagon, as I said, is the principal god of the Philistines. Because of what the word means and the origin, it's often, he's referred to as the fish god, the god that ruled Nineveh when Jonah went there, a god who ruled the sea, ruled the air, and the god in their mythology that was the father of Baal. So he was the god not only of the seas, but of fertility, and he was the height of their religion. And now they see Yahweh as coming in and serving at the pleasure of their great God. But that's not what happens. Verse 3, the people of Ashdod rose early the next day. Imagine this scene. After this great military victory, you put this God of the Israelites in your temple, and you wake up the next morning. Maybe you just want to go gloat over it. Maybe you just want to revel in the moment. Maybe you go there to worship for whatever reason. You get up early and you go, and this is what they discover. Instead of a Dagon statue, idol, that's ready to be worshiped, that's ready to receive sacrifice, and this is such a great scene, they see this idol fallen face down before the ark of the Lord. What is face down? That's the posture of worship. This God was supposed to be subject to Dagon, but now Dagon is in the posture of subjection. He's in the posture of submission. Now, no doubt they asked the question that we would ask if you walked into a room and something fell down. You think, well, how did that happen? Did something wake you up last night? Was there an earthquake? I didn't feel anything. Maybe it was small. Maybe someone came in and knocked it over. So they seem to just render it to circumstance. They don't know what brought this about. They just know it's on his face. And so they took Dagon and they put him back in his place. Now, that is intended to be humorous. That we are intended to see the irony here. Can I suggest to you that it should have been a bit of a wake-up call when you have to pick your own God up and place him back on a shelf? This God that you see is all-powerful, this God that you see is worthy of your worship, and you having to go, oh, let's pick him up. Beep. You know, that's the sound it made, I'm sure of it. But that little bitty God, I got to pick him up, I got to put him back on a shelf because he fell over. It's a pathetic picture. Let's pick our God back up and take him off the floor so he can stand there again and be worthy of our worship. The fact that the Philistines had to reposition the idol is another allusion to Dagon's inferiority. He couldn't act on his own. These are the words of Isaiah 46. They lift it, the idols on their shoulder. They carry it. They set it in its place and it stands there. It doesn't move. Though one may shout at it, it can't answer. It cannot serve from his distress. That's the nature of idols. Nonetheless, that's what they do. And the ridiculousness of the scene is highlighted because we know what's going on. Imagine the ridiculousness of this picture. A statue, you walk into a house and you see someone talking to a statue that's on a shelf and it falls over. And they pick it up and they put it back and they reposition it. It's in a spot and then they talk to it again. They ask of it. Things. They ask for this statue that they just picked up off the floor to bless them. It's a ridiculous picture. It's intended to be a ridiculous picture. Listen to how idols are described. There's so many passages. Let me highlight a couple. Psalm 115. Why should the nations say, "Where is their God?" Our God is in the heavens. He does all that he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of human hands. They have mouths, but they do not speak. They have eyes, but they don't see. They have ears, but they don't hear. They have noses, but they don't smell. They have hands, but they don't feel. They have feet, but they don't walk. They don't make a sound in their throat. Those who make them become like them, so do all who trust in them. This is the same language that Isaiah uses later. These idols that they're worshiping, he's like, some carpenter went out into the forest and he cut down a tree. And he brings it home, this little piece of a tree, and then he carves out a statue. Oh, this is my God. He just made it. The irony there being, there's a God who made that tree, and now he's carving an idol out of a tree that the true God actually made, that spoke into existence, and now he's carving a little idol and he sets it on a shelf. Or the metal worker casts an idol and does the same thing. It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous picture. And we're supposed to see that here. To worship these idols is folly. So they pick up their God and they go to bed. You know, that was some strange coincidence that happened last night. They get up early the next morning. They come back in with anticipation again. But what do they find? The same thing, only worse. Verse 4, they rose early the next morning and Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground again. Before the ark of the Lord again. And the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left. So not only is he face down and bowing before the ark again in the position of worship, but his head is severed and his hands are cut off. Now in the ancient Near East, one of the ways that you exercised dominance over your enemy is when you defeated them, they often would cut off their heads. One of the reasons they did that was just to keep track of the numbers. It was easier to count heads than it was to count bodies on the battlefield. As horrible as that sounds, that's the picture. It's a picture of total defeat. We're going to see this later in 1 Samuel, right? Chapter 17, David's going to fight this guy named Goliath. And what does he do when he defeats him? He cuts off his head. This one who worshiped Dagon, who lost his head, is now headless in this field. Chapter 31, it happens to Samuel where his hands are cut off. We see it in 2 Samuel as well. What's the picture? This is it. Don't be mistaken, Philistines. You think you have Yahweh in your possession and your temple? You think you've won the battle, so you've won me? I didn't lose the battle. I'm not the one that was defeated on the field of battle that day. And for Dagon to lose his head in his hands in the presence of the Ark of Yahweh meant that Yahweh was conquering Dagon. That's the picture. And even more than that, he defeated him in his home turf, right? Dagon had home field advantage. It's a big deal in sports, right? Big deal in battle. He had home field advantage. And on his turf, in his temple, he subjugated Dagon to himself. Literally executed this god on his home field. And so the Philistines are confronted with the reality that this Yahweh is not a tribal deity, that he's free to exercise his sovereignty wherever in the world he wants. He's not a god that belongs to one people. He's not a god that belongs to one area like their gods. Wherever he goes, he rules. 1 Chronicles 29, yours, O Lord, is the greatness and the power and the glory and the victory and the majesty. For all that is in the heavens and in the earth is yours. Yours is the kingdom, O Lord. You are exalted as head above all. Psalm 97, 9, for you, O Lord, are most high over all the earth. You are exalted far above all gods. In Daniel, these are the words spoken to King Nebuchadnezzar. His dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, and he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. Paul would say the same thing in Acts 17. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in temples made by men. He is the God over all. And he makes that point clearly on this morning. Let me just in passing kind of application, a note of encouragement to you. When you struggle with doubt, one of the greatest encouragements I can give you, there's a lot of things to do when you're struggling with doubt about God and questions about God, but one of the first things I would encourage you to do is look up. Look at the mountains. Look at the heavens. Look at the trees. Look at the sky. Look at the stars. Look up. Because the God that we worship is the God of creation. And I don't know of anything, humanly speaking, that other than Christ himself, but this is what Romans 1 says, that God makes his attributes on clear display for everyone. And when you have questions, you come back to how did all this get here? The God of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Paul, this God spoke this into existence. I find that to be a remarkable, remarkable help when we struggle with any issue of doubt.
And you're listening to Growing in Grace with Pastor Steve Ballantyne from San Gabriel Community Church. If you have questions or comments about the broadcast, maybe you have a prayer request, please reach out to us. We'd love to help out any way that we can. You can reach out to us at 626-656-1000 or stop by our website and drop us an email, sangabrielcommunity.org. If you're looking to join us for worship, we meet at 9 a.m., Sunday school at 10:45, and directions and information, again, can be found at sangabrielcommunity.org or by simply calling 626-656-1000. By the way, as you stop by our website, you'll find an archive of past sermons available to listen to, information about us, who we are, what we believe, and why. Pastor Steve's blog is available from our website as well, and information about San Gabriel Christian School. Please stop by sangabrielcommunity.org or call 626-656-1000. Please remember, as you contact us, this is a listener-supported ministry. As you link arms with us prayerfully and financially, we are able to continue the ministry here in the greater Los Angeles area. Please consider that as you contact us, won't you? Thank you so much for spending time with us today. We look forward to seeing you next week at the same time for another broadcast of Growing in Grace with Pastor Steve Valentine. Growing in Grace is the ministry of San Gabriel Community Church.